the topic that I've chosen to speak on is free will, and I gave it the title "Free Will: A Necessary Illusion?" Question mark. The question mark's very important. So the problem of free will is one of the deepest and potentially most troubling problems in philosophy. In fact, it's a whole nest of problems once you start to look into it. It's very hard to sum up. But the problems tend to bug various philosophers and lead to intense and often very complex debates. And there can seem to be quite a lot at stake with this issue. It's a debate that's central in philosophy, I think, because it raises both metaphysical and ethical problems. That's to say, it makes us ask, to put it in a very general way, it makes us ask how human beings are placed within the world at large. What kind of things are human beings? What kind of things are their actions and their states of mind? How do they fit in with the world? But it also calls on us to ask how we're to regard actions from the point of view of ethical value. For example, what's the basis of our assigning praise and blame or responsibility to ourselves and to others? In fact, I think it's this pressure from ethics and the idea of responsibility, being responsible for our actions, that deep down seems to drive many of the various debates about free will. So that just gives perhaps a sense that at the end of the day it's a very big set of issues, not just one, and perhaps it's too big to have any simple yes or no answer. Okay, I'll start with a simple statement of the supposed problem about free will, which is fairly traditional. And as usual in philosophy, it's quite good to start with something that everyone should agree with. So the first thing that sets up the problem is, the first part of it is, each of us has a point of view from which we regard our own actions. Actions are just simply things we do. Anything. So we have an attitude that we naturally take to our own actions. So from your own point of view, it's natural to think that many of your actions, perhaps most of your actions, much of what you do is, as we say, up to you, in quotes, if you like. So much of what you do is, or probably most of what you do, you think, is up to you, rather than depending on factors that are outside your control. So you have desires. By desires, philosophers just mean things you want. You have things you want, you make choices, you sometimes stop to think about what to do, you deliberate, you take decisions, and when you act to carry out these desires, choices, deliberations, decisions, you commonly regard yourself as acting freely. So it could just cover anything, examples great and small, from choosing to drink tea rather than coffee this morning, to, you know, which party to vote for in the local elections, whether to go and settle in another country and marry somebody, and, you know, big decisions. It doesn't matter, they're all on the same level as regards this sense that they're up to us. So that, I think, I'm hoping everybody agrees with. That's what it feels like. But there is another point of view you could take towards your actions. Your actions are events in the world. They're part of what happens in the overall scheme of things. Put it that way. Your actions occur at a certain place and time, and in relation to other things that happen. So thinking this through, some people have found it begins to seem unavoidable that those happenings that are your actions are subject to necessitation, as you might say, being made necessary or control by other things that happen. It can come to seem that what you do, is determined. So the traditional problem of free will is that how can we be free if determinism is true? Determinism, then, is the name given to various doctrines which appear to conflict with free will. And I've just taken a little bit of a list from a book by Robert Kane, American philosopher who's written quite a bit on this topic. He, introducing the problem, he lists various determining factors that he, as he calls them, that might have concerned various thinkers about this, thinking about this problem. Some of them, so this is what Kane says, determining factors might include fate or God, the laws of physics, heredity and environment, unconscious motives, psychological or social conditioning, behavioural engineers and hidden controllers. The hidden controllers sound a little bit science fiction to me, so I'm not going to talk about those. But finally, he says, any event is determined just in case it must be the case that, given the determining conditions, the determined event will occur. So that's the idea that we're in this context of all sorts of things that are impinging on us, and determinism's the idea that whatever those factors are, given those factors in the environment that we're in, what we do must happen in some sense. It's necessitated, it's determined. So I'm going to leave out God and fate and the behavioural controllers and whatever they were. The reason for leaving out God and fate is not because it's not an important issue. In the Middle Ages, when this debate first really got going in Western philosophy, obviously God's foreknowledge and God's predestination of the whole of creation was one of the main issues that concerned them with whether there was free will. But I think if you don't believe in God and you don't have that whole religious picture of the world, the issue of being determined by God doesn't really arise. So I'm going to leave that aside as a topic in philosophy of religion specifically. So I'll talk about ideas about causal determinism, being determined by causes. So this would be roughly, very roughly, the doctrine that every event, everything that happens, has a cause or causes, and that given an event's causes, the happening of the event is determined or necessary. Or every event has a cause or causes, and anything that happens could in principle be predicted if we knew enough about its causes. So the debate about free will is driven, I think, by this initial thought that we can't be genuinely free if determinism is true. So no less than any other event, any other happening in the world, what you do issues from causes. And if our actions have causes which determine them, and for which they could in principle be predicted, in what sense is what we do up to us, as we said at the beginning? Well, a couple of questions one can raise immediately. Well, there are many, but one is, well, are we going to end up having to say that our sense of being free that I spoke of at the beginning is just a product of severely limited knowledge? Right, maybe we can't predict human behaviour entirely because our understanding is too limited. The causes are so complex, so difficult to fathom. I mean, we don't really know about the genetic causes, the social causes, the causes that my brain states impose upon my actions, and so on. And maybe we never will. Maybe it will never really work out the causes sufficiently to be able to predict absolutely, reliably human behaviour. But then, are we in danger of thinking then that free will is just going to become an illusion? We'll unavoidably have the sense that things are up to us, but we'll carry on thinking that just because we can't actually work out how to predict them fully. We'll only ever really know enough. We'll never really know enough to see what is really causing us to act. So that's a thought, that perhaps free will might be an illusion. Of course, it could be a very good thing that we're under this illusion, if it were an illusion. Perhaps it's a necessary illusion that we couldn't live without. And you might well think, well, we couldn't regard ourselves and others as genuinely acting, even as generally agents, genuinely doing things, unless we assumed we were free. Where would our sense of responsibility go? Would we have to regard ourselves as just like other animals or other parts of nature to which we attribute no freedom at all? So, if free will is an illusion, it might be unavoidable because we just never know enough to dispel the illusion, but it also might be a good illusion, might be vitally important to us to be able to carry on our lives as active, responsible human beings. I'm not very happy with that idea, though. And I think most people who work on this sort of issue aren't very happy with the idea that free will is an illusion, even if it's a very good illusion to be under. I think most of us really want it to be true that we're free, at least in some sense. Or at any rate true that we're genuinely responsible for our actions. Another question you can ask, of course, is whether determinism really is true. Is there any theoretical view which makes it the case that everything that happens is necessitated by its causes? And you might want to dispute that. You might want to maintain some kind of indeterminism, that it's impossible in principle to predict the next state of the universe from its present state in some radical way. But I'm not sure that will help. As many people have said this, I think, the idea that my actions are undetermined by anything doesn't really seem to be what we want from the notion of freedom. The idea that because I think we want it to be the sense that, well, my actions are somehow rooted in my character. There's something important about me which is responsible for those bringing those actions about. And if there's somehow no really strong, tight connection between my actions and my character, for example, then the sense of there being my actions, or they're being up to me, seems also to disappear with the notion of them not being determined at all. So I'm not going to debate now whether determinism's true. In fact, the most intense debate in philosophy in this area isn't about whether determinism's true. That's a question, but it's not the most. It's not what philosophers find most interesting. There's a different debate, a different division of opinion around a different question, and this is a conditional question. The question is, if determinism is true, does that mean we have no free will? It's a question about the relation between determinism, supposing it might be true, and free will. So people who answer yes to that question are commonly known as incompatibilists. They think that free will is incompatible with determinism. So everything's determined, there's no such thing as free will. People who answer no, on the other hand, are called compatibilists. They think that the truth of determinism is compatible with the truth of the claim that human beings have free will. And actually, compatibilism, I would say, is probably, well, certainly, the most popular general outlook, general line of thought that philosophers try to defend these days. So people don't want to have to deny determinism, but they want to say, well, it's okay, really, because we can still, in an important sense, be free. Well, everything we want out of the notion of freedom is compatible with determinism. Not everybody thinks that, but it's quite a popular line. So there is what some people call classical compatibilism, and people often refer to Hobbes and Hume, 17th and 18th century philosophers, who say, well, look, to be free, it's not really a big deal. All we mean when we say that someone's free is something like this. So Hobbes talks about liberty, actually, instead of freedom here, but says Hobbes talks about the liberty of the man consisteth in this, that he finds no stop in doing what he has the will, desire, or inclination to do. That's from Hobbes's Leviathan. somebody finds no stop or hindrance in doing what he has the will, desire, or inclination to do. Then we call somebody free. David Hume, a bit later, had a very similar idea. He said that really all we want out of freedom is this, the power of acting or not acting according to the determinations of the will. That is, Hume's very clear, if we choose to remain at rest, we may. If we choose to move, we also may. So this could be called freedom, at least freedom of acting, freedom of to do what you want or what you will. So you wouldn't have this freedom if you were tied down by shackles, or if you were imprisoned in a very small room, or if you had been injected with some drug that disabled you from doing things and so on. Those would be cases in which you wouldn't be free, because you might have things you wanted to do, but you were prevented from doing them. Well, fine, that's a sense of freedom, I think, but I think a lot of people have a feeling that doesn't really go far enough into the problem. And I seem to be skipping forward one century at a time, but in the 19th century, Schopenhauer talked about this idea of freedom to act and said, well, actually, what about what you will? Hume says, you know, if you will to do it, if you want to do it, you can, or you may. Schopenhauer says, well, what about what you will? Is that up to you? So Schopenhauer, and other people have put this kind of objection, I think, says that freedom of acting is crucially different from freedom of willing. So it might be very true that, I don't know, let's take an example. Suppose you vote Labour. If you'd wanted to vote Conservative, you could have done. So, you know, nobody forced you. You weren't restrained, paralysed, drugged, locked in a room. So if you had wanted to vote Conservative, you could have done. So in that sense, you were free. But that doesn't tell us anything about whether you could have wanted that. Could you have wanted to vote Conservative? Yeah. Could you have willed that? So if you'd willed it, fine. But could you have willed it? And Schopenhauer gives a very eloquent, I think, account of a kind of determinist view in which, given my character, which I can't change at will, given the experiences that come my way on a particular occasion, those factors, right, the experiences I have and the character that they impinge upon, determines my action. So there's a sense in which on that particular occasion I couldn't have done otherwise. Could have done if I'd wanted to, but I couldn't have wanted anything different. Nevertheless, says Schopenhauer, we have a sense of being the doers of our deeds. And this is the sense of what philosophers more recently call agency, being an agent, being a doer, rather than a piece of the world that something just happens to. So, you know, if somebody knocks me off my chair and I fall over, that isn't something I did, it's something that happened to me, but we have a sense that a lot of what goes on is something I do, I'm an agent. And Schopenhauer quite interestingly comments that even if we believe that it wasn't up to us what we did, we still have a sense of being the doers of it. We still have a sense of agency. So this might take us in a bit of a different direction, of a kind of compatibilist view. We might want to say, well, even if we are fully determined in our actions, that doesn't remove our sense of being responsible for them. So maybe it doesn't have to be true that I could have done otherwise in order for me to be free, or at least in order for me to be responsible for my actions. Maybe it doesn't need to be the case that I could have done otherwise. And a couple of more recent philosophers have thought about this issue very deeply, and I'll just mention a couple of thoughts. There's one set of thoughts by Daniel Dennett, a well-known American philosopher, and some others by P.F. Strawson, the distinguished Oxford philosopher. Just a couple of thoughts that tend to in a compatibilist direction, that is to say, the thought that if everything we do is determined, whatever that exactly means, if we couldn't have ever done otherwise on a particular occasion, it doesn't take away our responsibility for our actions. So Dennett, Daniel Dennett, he's thinking about the case of Martin Luther, who famously, in his confrontation against the established church, said, "Here I stand, I can do no other." Right. So Dennett says, well, this is a quote from Dennett, "Luther claimed he could do no other, that his conscience made it impossible for him to recant. His declaration is testimony to the fact that we simply do not exempt someone from praise or blame for an act because we think he could do no other. Whatever Luther was doing, he was not trying to duck responsibility." So even if it's true that it was impossible for him to do anything else, that doesn't mean he wasn't responsible for what he did. Dennett uses another example. He says, look, if somebody offered me $1,000 to torture an innocent person, he says he's pretty sure he would never accept that. So imagine it happened and on some particular occasion he turned down the offer, said, no thanks, I won't take $1,000 to torture that person. Let's say he couldn't have done otherwise. It just was not in him to take money to torture an innocent person. So on that particular occasion when he turned down the money, he couldn't have done otherwise, similarly to the Luther case. But then he asks, well, suppose I did decline on a particular occasion, would that act be an act I wasn't responsible for? And he expects that we'll answer no. So this suggests that we already believe that being responsible doesn't require that we could have done otherwise. And if that's true, then that really sets the debate in a different, puts the debate in a different light. So I just mentioned Strawson, P.F. Strawson. He wrote an essay way back in 1962. It's often still referred to, Strawson, Freedom and Resentment. And Strawson pointed out some facts that are familiar, that we sometimes say people are not responsible. So if someone's severely psychotic on an occasion, or somebody's drugged in a certain way, or suffering from dementia, or if they're a two-year-old, we take different attitudes to them. We think that the person's behavior should be managed, or they should be protected, kept away from harming others. We don't blame them or resent their actions or feel gratitude. So these attitudes that we take towards each other are suspended in those sorts of cases, says Strawson. We take an objective attitude to the person. So in all these cases we would try to explain what's going on, predict the consequences, prevent the harm, cure or remove the causes. So we're sort of managing the person's behavior rather than taking these attitudes of praise and blame and so on towards them. But so we can understand the idea that some human behavior the human beings in question are not responsible for. But that's a special kind of case, as he points out. And it's not, okay, why don't we hold these people responsible? It's not because their actions are determined by something or other, right? Normally, outside of these kinds of cases, we resent people's actions if they are of a certain kind, or we feel grateful to them, or we admire them for doing things, or we blame them, or we praise them. There are all these attitudes which he calls reactive attitudes. So we react to someone's action with gratitude, with resentment. He uses the notion of resentment as the central one. We can't resent, if a dog bites me, I can't resent the dog doing it. You know, I can be angry that it's happened, hope it doesn't happen again, and so on. But I can't resent the dog's doing it somehow. So there are all sorts of things that happen which it's not appropriate to resent. But we do have these interpersonal reactive attitudes, as Strawson calls them. And his argument is, it's so much a part of being human to have these attitudes, that we can't genuinely imagine not having them. We can't imagine treating all human behaviour in the way that we treat those who we say are not responsible. So, as he says, Strawson, it's a short, very short quote from Strawson, he says, "We cannot seriously envisage ourselves adopting a thoroughgoing objectivity of attitude to others as a result of a theoretical conviction of the truth of determinism." So, actually, Strawson says he doesn't even know what determinism means, so he's not even going to debate whether it's true or not. But suppose there is something that's true there, would it make us stop feeling resentful to people who do certain kinds of harm? Would it make us stop blaming people, stop praising them, stop admiring them, stop feeling gratitude to them? He says we can't imagine that. So Dennett says, in the previous example, to be responsible, we don't have to think that determinism is false. Strawson says, even if we thought something called determinism was true, we can't imagine it anyway, changing those ingrained interpersonal attitudes that all go together with this presumption of responsibility. So those are two broadly compatibilist sets of thoughts, that even if something like determinism is true and we couldn't have done otherwise when we act, it doesn't affect our ability to be responsible for our actions or hold others responsible for their actions. So, where has the problem of free will gone? All right, there's this sort of sense that it might have evaporated a bit now. Well, I'd just like to end with a couple of rather wide-ranging thoughts. Perhaps in a way there isn't genuinely a problem of free will, in the sense that what's traditionally been set up, where we started with this clash of determinism and free will, perhaps that's a problem that could not have a solution. So we talked a bit about regarding people objectively, or Strawson used that term. We might also talk about regarding human beings theoretically, from a theoretical standpoint. By that I mean treating human beings as part of the real natural world, observing human beings, explaining them, trying to predict their behaviour. We do all that with the rest of nature, so why not with ourselves, right? Why not take this theoretical, observational, objective stance towards ourselves? Why not place ourselves among the phenomena in the world that we can study, and try and study ourselves as dispassionately and non-subjectively as we can manage? In fact, there seems to be a scientific imperative to do that. To leave human beings out of our objective study of what's in reality would seem just wrong. But then everything about human beings looks on a par with the rest of nature, right? Just more complicated and probably harder for us to be objective about, but you know, we should still try. Everything human has its causes, which we can study and discover. But not to think that would be to exclude ourselves from having a place in objective reality. And that doesn't look very good, right? I mean, human beings are part of the real world that we need to be able to study objectively. But at the same time, we retain our own point of view on our actions, which we could call a subjective point of view, or, if you like, a practical point of view. So subjective as opposed to objective, practical as opposed to theoretical. So we're conscious of ourselves from our own particular point of view, and we're conscious of ourselves as the ones who are called upon to act. So when I ask, what do I want and what should I do, it's hopeless just to look at myself theoretically from outside, objectively, as it were, trying to explain what's going on in me and predict what will happen next, as if somehow I was part of a scientific project. So here's a suggestion. The problem of free will arises, perhaps, when we start insisting on pushing the subjective and the objective, or the theoretical and the practical views of ourselves into one single picture, and then sort of letting them fight it out together. Either things that we do are up to us, or they're fully caused and explicable. Which is it? But what if we're just stuck with these two different perspectives, and neither of them is preferable, or certainly neither of them is reducible to the other? We've got to be able to view ourselves objectively as part of what's going on in nature, and we've also got to be able to view ourselves as agents, as people who are called upon to act in a situation. So this may also sound like a problem, right? We're stuck with these two different perspectives that we try to apply to ourselves. I guess that is a problem, but it sounds less like one that we should be pressing to solve rather than one we may just have to live with.